really love installing, upgrading, and fixing security agents in my cloud estate. Why do I say that? Because I sell things for a company that deploys an agent. There's no other reason. Because let's face it, agents can be a real headache. Well, Orca Security now gives you a single tool to detect basically every risk in your cloud environment that's as easy to install and maintain as a smartphone app. It is agentless, or my intro would have gotten me in trouble here, but it can still see deep into your AWS workloads while guaranteeing 100% coverage. With Orca Security, there are no overlooked assets, no DevOps headaches, and believe me, you will hear from those people if you cause them headaches, and no performance hits on live environment. Connect your first cloud account in minutes and see for yourself at orca.security. That's orca as in whale, dot security as in that thing your company claims to care about but doesn't until right after it really should have. How AWS makes its billions, $13 billion in operating income in 2020 alone, to support the bulk of Amazon's net income is a question that stumps the public. To shine some light on the topic, CNBC's Jordan Novit published an article on AWS's estimated margins on a per-service basis. Amazon obviously isn't publishing its margins and billing structure for all of us plebeians to pick apart, and for some unfathomable reason, they haven't opened their books to me for casual inspection, but I've got some good guesses about how it works. I chatted with Jordan at length as he researched this article, and he did cite me. There's still a lot of nuance to the question of how AWS bills for its services and realizes profits that doesn't neatly fit into an article intended for a mass market audience, but luckily, that doesn't describe you, dear listener. Let's look at which AWS line items are the moneymakers here. First, my assertion that EC2 represents a majority share of the spend is relatively uncontroversial. If you run ECS or EKS without Fargate, you're paying either nothing or a small management fee, respectively, to run what the bill lists as a bunch of EC2 instances. A number of services take that model. One outlier is Amazon EMR, which charges a per-instance management fee on top of the, you guessed it, EC2 fee. After that, big drivers are S3, RDS, Data Transfer, and Elastic Block Store. Incidentally, that last one shows up on the AWS bill under the disturbingly broad catch-all category of EC2-Other. There's one other point raised in the article that I think is worth addressing, that AWS Lambda can wind up charging almost double the price of EC2 instances. It's one of those things that is mathematically true on paper, but in practice, it makes little if any sense. Yes, you can absolutely beat the economics of Lambda if you have perfect foreknowledge of your EC2 usage so you can buy 3-year savings plans or reserved instances. The trouble is, predicting usage patterns like that is hard, and few workloads are consistent minute by minute, hour by hour, day by day. Lambda gets you an awful lot of, it looks like, but don't call it that, autoscaling as well. Lambda at Edge's economics are significantly worse than all of this and should be excluded from the conversation completely, as well as your production environment and AWS's entire cloud offering. AWS is clearly a company built out of small teams. Amazon talks about this constantly in the context of two pizza teams, no larger than you could feed with two large pizzas. Well, set aside entirely how laughable a concept it is that a company with 17 ways to run containers could ever agree on pizza toppings at all. The two-pizza philosophy clearly leads to what presents as a per-service, if not a per-feature, margin target. I find what this suggests to be relatively abhorrent. AWS is giving each service team margin targets rather than viewing profitability as a cohesive cross-org strategic goal. We know that the AWS billing system is an exabyte-scale problem from conference talks, public statements, and a variety of job postings talking about the team's work. Despite a fairly sizable infrastructure required to generate those bills, AWS doesn't present customers with a separate charge for the billing itself. Here's your bill, please pay it, and then pay me for billing you. The cost of that system is clearly subsidized by the other services that customers are directly charged for. This is as it should be. But by not applying this model to other areas of the business, AWS is getting it wrong while actively incentivizing certain customer profiles to avoid AWS entirely. Nowhere is this more evident than data transfer. Here's an example. If cross-AZ data transfer were free instead of costing $20,000 per petabyte transferred, what would happen? Customers would have more architectures that span multiple availability zones, meaning that there would be more storage and compute provisioned. Traffic over the presumably dedicated fiber between availability zones would increase, but seeing as AWS almost certainly owns everything between those two AZs, it would manifest as a potential one-time upgrade investment. Then, of course, AWS would take a hit to its next quarterly earnings as that change manifested across its customers. Yes, I do believe that charge to be significant enough to materially change quarterly earnings. That said, think of the goodwill earned by not surprising customers who discover the 2 cent per gigabyte charge the hard way. It would start to feel a bit more like AWS were partnering with customers to build out their durable applications rather than preying upon them. If Amazon truly is a company with a longer-term view than quarterly numbers, this strikes me as a relatively easy win. This episode is sponsored in part by you, Gabyte. Distributed technologies like Kubernetes are great, citation very much needed, because they make it easier to have resilient, scalable systems. SQL databases haven't kept pace, though. Certainly not like NoSQL databases have, like Route 53, the world's greatest database. We're still, other than that, using legacy, monolithic databases that require ever-growing instances of compute. Sometimes we'll try and bolt them together to make them more resilient and scalable, but let's be honest, it never works out well. Consider Yugabyte DB. It's a distributed SQL database that solves basically all of this. It is 100% open source, and there's no asterisk next to the open on that one. And it's designed to be resilient and scalable out of the box so you don't have to shard yourself to death. It's compatible with PostgreSQL, or PostgreSQL as I insist on pronouncing it, so you can use it right away without having to learn a whole new language and refactor everything. And you can distribute it wherever your applications take you, from across availability zones to other regions or even other cloud providers should one of those happen to exist. Go to yugabyte.com, that's Yugabyte.com, and try their free beta of Yugabyte Cloud, where they host and manage it for you. Or see what the open source project looks like. It's effortless distributed SQL for global apps. My thanks to you, Gabyte, for sponsoring this episode. Here's another example, stepping away entirely from data transfer and, of course, the dreaded managed NAT gateway, the usurious egress, free ingress charges, etc. CloudWatch Logs charges 50 cents per gigabyte ingested into the system, and then 3 cents per month to store it. The customer takeaway here is to log less, lest you be charged for it. By default, CloudWatch log groups never expire, so this is an area of unbounded growth that's usually small enough to go overlooked until one day a customer discovers they've been paying a tax on going about their business for the last decade and configures some rotation or expiry rules. Lastly, observe the fact that SageMaker savings plans are completely distinct from the compute savings plans for EC2, Lambda, and Fargate. This smacks of each business unit needing to protect, demonstrate, and defend its own margins at the cost of doing what's right for customers. Cloud cost and cloud architecture are the same thing. By incentivizing behavior that puts the team margins ahead of the business's goals, customers are often pressured into suboptimal architectures by the nature of their commitments. It's needless. The money is going to go to AWS either way. What possible value to the customer is there in forcing it to flow to one service team instead of another? At times, it's easy to mistake my position on AWS bills as saying that they're too high. Let me be very clear here. I have no objection to paying an AWS bill that is higher than the one I pay today, provided I am able to easily predict and understand the drivers of that bill. Most customers would if given that choice. The CNBC article left industry insiders with a big point for discussion. What should AWS's approach to product margins be? For me, it's not the AWS margins that I begrudge. It's the complexity foisted upon its customers. That complexity is encouraged in part by what appears to be each service team needing to hit margin targets instead of delighting customers. So much of what's hidden in an AWS bill isn't an expense that a customer isn't prepared or willing to pay if they were informed about it up front and left to consider the trade-offs. Rather, it's the result of such stupendous complexity that customers did not realize they were paying for it. In the platonic ideal of AWS billing, the Duckbill Group should have a much smaller market than it does. We should be focusing on helping customers negotiate their contracts with AWS far more than on cost optimization projects. I don't know how we get there from here, but I do know that AWS's apparent current model of per-team margin targets leaves us all the poorer for it as customers.
This has been a Humble Pod production.
Stay humble.